Well, again, I want to say this is part two of my commencement address. And I'll ask a question: why should we take the resurrection of Jesus seriously? Let's, you know, more seriously than, let's say, an alleged sighting of a UFO. I mean, if you talk to the main society, they would be much more excited in a UFO sighting than it ever be in, say, some miracle that happened, that alleged miracle of Jesus. So I want to ask a question. What is the basic difference between the Christian church and, say, a cult like Heaven's Gate? You remember Heaven's Gate? Heaven's Gate was like 20 years ago. It was in San Diego, California, where a bunch of people actually got together and committed suicide. They had a mass suicide by they ate some applesauce poisoned with something else. And because they said there was a UFO coming, it was hidden behind a comet, and the UFO was coming to take them home. And so it was an apocalyptic event, and they wanted to be ready for, they wanted to be taken out of the world before the end of the world. And so they got one thing right. They did leave the world before the world ended. That's one thing they did. They got that right. As Christians, we believe in something completely different, don't we? We believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. We believe Jesus is alive today. We believe that Jesus is coming back to take his people, and he's going to rule the world, and we build our lives and reality around that, around those truths. That cult that I just spoke about, they evidently believed in something else. They believed that there was a UFO behind the Hale-Bopp comet, and they built their lives and their deaths around that. Someone would say, pick your poison, pick your myth, you know, because a lot of people would put Christianity in the myth column. But there are numerous differences between cults, and there's a lot of cults out there, and it's, you know, and I wish there were more college. Well, we got some kids that are going to go to college, hopefully, in the future, that are among us. But they'll be there, the cults will be there, they'll be trying to recruit their people. New people, because when college kids go to college for the first time, they're kind of lost, right? They need a sense of, they need a group. They need to be significant with another group. And so they are fresh prey for the cults. I'm just warning you about that, okay? And so they're looking for the lost soul that needs to find a community to be involved in. And they'll snatch you up if you're not ready for that. But let me mention a few of the reasons that are, and try to answer the question, why should we take seriously the claim that Jesus rose from the dead? Because that is a claim that Christianity really is built, the foundation of Christianity is built on, the idea that the reality that Jesus Christ physically rose from the dead. But first, a few differences between cults and historic Christianity. One, Christianity is rooted in several thousand years of God's act in history. So that really we can read about those different acts in the Bible. If you go to Llewellyn Sunday School on a Sunday morning, you're going to hear all about the different acts that God performed for the Jewish people. And Caleb is nodding his head. He's been through a lot of those classes. Is rooted in several thousand years of God's act in history. It's not the speculation of some charismatic leader. A lot of times, cults will be formed around some person who seems to have charisma, or in this day, they say riz, okay? They have the riz. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, they experienced a covenant with God, which led to the establishment of the people known as the Israelites. These people escaped. These are the acts of God, right? The merciful acts of God, the provision of God for the people of God. The people escaped from Egypt by the mighty deeds of God. The people of Israel received a law. They received land. They received prophets that brought the message of God to the people. So there's 2,000 years of recorded history dealing with God's, over 2,000 years, with God's word and his work, and it leads to, all this leads up to the fulfillment of the prophecies and the coming of the Messiah, the Son of God, Jesus. And Jesus came in a particular historical place in the world. He came in a particular time, and it's all recorded. And he even came into what we call the secular humanist society, like Herod and Pontius Pilate and others who were running the Roman Empire. And so this fulfillment is not narrated in the New Testament by one leader who might have been in a trance, okay? Like, you know, some, if you look at some of the interesting stories about the leaders of the cults. But these are nine or a few reluctant and very skeptical men who were surrounded by people who were so close to the events recorded that they really couldn't have falsified these wild and crazy claims. Okay? Someone could have looked and said, hey, that's not true. We were there too. So Christianity, you must remember, is rooted in real history. Now, I don't know how much time, if you go to the public school, they're going to talk about Jesus. But he should be part of your history class, world history. Because he was a real man and came into a particular time in history. And is the most influential person that ever lived. And so because of this connection with history, Christianity has produced thousands of years of schools and scholarship that are accessible to secular scrutiny and debate. Christianity is not a private knowledge. It is a public knowledge. Our documents are public and are open to natural reading for anyone. The Bible is the most printed book in the world, isn't it? From my understanding. We do not claim to have a holy man somewhere who dispenses impossible meanings to certain texts. The book is rooted in real history. As a matter of fact, some of the Old Testament books would be called historical books. They're not mythology. And so there's been 2,000 years of people coming together, debating in the marketplace of ideas, is Jesus, you know, the claims of Christ. Christianity is the most historical of all religious movements. Christianity has universal validity and relevance across all cultures. It's not just in the Middle East. It's not in the West. You can go to any continent. How many continents are there, by the way? Very good. Seven continents out there. And wherever you go, in every continent, there will be believers in Christ. It has transcended all the ethnic groups in the world. This is point four. Christianity has endured the test of time. Again and again, people have predicted that Christianity will somehow vanish from the face of the earth. If you just get the right movement. But time and time again, it has shown that it is relevant, it is powerful. And even when there's these radically modern movements that try, they think they can banish religion, it's not going to happen. Point five, at the center of historic Christianity is the absolutely unique person of Jesus Christ. There's no one comparable at the center of any other cult or religion. And I'm not trying to hold up and say, you know, choose the cult or choose Christianity. Really, they're not even on the same level, okay? As a matter of fact, when it comes to cults, they like to piggyback off Christianity to somehow legitimize their own sort of religion. But what they don't tell you up front is that they have a completely different view of who Jesus Christ is. That's an important thing. They'll hide it at first because they're trying to gain your trust and they're trying to bring you in, and they're not going to really tell you. They might say, oh, we believe in Jesus, but they're not going to say on what level or who Jesus is in their view, okay? There was Marshall Applewhite. He was the leader of Heaven's Gate back in San Diego over 20 years ago. Some would say that the leader of that cult, he's the same as Jesus. They were both deluded, apocalyptic fanatics who were out of touch with reality. That's what they would say. And that's what the human secularists would say today because, quite frankly, they don't believe in God. So any mention of God, you know, that's going to make them out of touch with reality, right? They'll say things like, well, we've moved beyond that. Science now is what really counts. Science is where you find the real truth. The universe is not created by God. They'll say it's more of a product of time and matter and chance. So anyone who claims to speak about God or for God or lead a people to God, that's impossible. That's got to be a cult of some sort because, quite frankly, there is no God, is what they'll say. Here was one famous, he was a philosopher of science, and he was at Yale, which is, used to be a prestigious Ivy League school. I don't know if it is anymore. I guess in its name it is, but he wrote a well-known essay entitled What I Do Not Believe. And basically, I won't read it here because I want to, you know, I'm kind of short on time, but the idea was I will not believe in God until if somehow the heavens would open up and God would, you know, would look down on me and call me by name and say, you know, I do exist. And he says, if that were to happen, I would believe. But here's the thing that is going to happen. God is going to rend the heavens. And we see that in Matthew 26, verse 64. It says, in the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. There will be a time when the heavens do open up and God will reveal himself. But here's the problem. If you have not put your faith in him before that time, it is too late. If we wait to see it before we believe it, it will be too late. Well, let's go back to the text that was read, John chapter 2. Why did Jesus say what he said about this great future appearance of the Son of Man? He said it because, in verse 63, at Jesus' trial, he said, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. So this is getting close to Christ's crucifixion. To which Jesus responded, yes, it is as you say, but I say to you all, in the future you will see the Son of Man. In other words, Jesus said, I am not only the Messiah, the Son of God, as you understand him to be, but I am more. I am going to die, then afterwards there will be a time coming when the whole universe will see me sitting at the right hand of God in glory. Now the question would be, what prompted the high priest to ask this man, Jesus, such an outrageous question? Are you the Messiah, the Son of God? We must back up a step, because in the midst of this trial, this false sham, where they brought the false witnesses before him, they said about this, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God, and I will rebuild it in 3 days. They brought a... That's what they brought to help accuse Jesus. This is what triggered the high priest's question. And he says, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you about you will rebuild the temple? Do you intend to destroy the temple? And do you think you can build it in 3 days? What kind of talk is this? What kind of person are you? But verse 63 says, Jesus remains silent. What are these false witnesses referring to? It goes back to that John chapter 2 and also in Mark 15 here. It says, because even when Jesus went on the cross, they said, they hurled insults at Jesus and they said, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross. So even when Jesus was hanging on the cross, they mentioned about him destroying the Jewish temple. Does any of this tell us why we should believe in this man and Jesus' resurrection? Before he comes in glory, should we believe in him before he comes? Or are we going to be like that one, the philosopher and atheist who wrote that essay saying, "This is the reasons I will not believe until I see God in his glory speak my name"? Well, the answer is found in John chapter 2. John comes to Jerusalem, Jesus comes to Jerusalem. He sees the money changers, he sees the merchants turning the house of God into a market, and he forms a whip and he drives them out and he says, "How dare you turn my Father's house into a market?" And the people demand of him, "What miraculous sign," here we go, the miraculous sign again, "can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" In other words, they want some evidence that he has authority to act like this, calling God his Father in some special sense, taking charge of the temple, which is a place where God's people are supposed to meet God. "What is your authority, Jesus, in doing that? What's your evidence that we should yield to you and not, you know, pummel you on the spot?" And the answer comes in verse 19. Jesus answered, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days." The people are flabbergasted by such an outrageous response. The Jews replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But then the writer John comments, he says, "But the temple he had spoken about was his body." Please don't miss the point of the shifting from the temple in Jerusalem to the temple of his body. That's what's going on here. He had just purged the temple in Jerusalem with a whip. He had called it his Father's house. The disciples recalled in Psalm 69:9, it says, "The zeal for your house will consume me." And the critics want a sign for his behavior. Jesus does not say, "I have nothing to say about your temple. I have only a word about my body." No, he does have something to say about the temple. He says, "Destroy the temple. The temple I just purged, the one you have turned into a marketplace, the one which I am consumed with zeal. But how? How will they destroy it? How will they bring the entire sacrificial system of the Old Testament to an end?" Well, they do it by crucifying Christ, don't they? Because Jesus then becomes the one and only perfect and final sacrifice. And so in doing that, he brings the Old Testament priesthood to an end. They, by rejecting Jesus, the Messiah, and putting him to death, when Jesus Christ died, Judaism, as it was enshrined in the temple, died. The final sacrifice was made with Christ's body. The sacrifice of Jesus ended all the sacrifices. The final high priest, Jesus was the final high priest, offered himself for the sin of the people. The Jewish priesthood had come to an end through the death of Jesus. Forty years after Jesus said these famous words, the Romans actually did destroy the temple in Jerusalem. But the decisive end of the Jewish temple sacrificial system came to an end when Christ offered his life on the cross. You see, no building, and you know, lately we've been talking about this building here, and the trustees I know have been, you know, how are we going to make sure this church sanctuary will stand for another 150 years, you know, how we can do that, you know, and it would be good for that to happen, but in the end, it's temporary. This building is temporary. From the day of Christ's death, Jesus says, "I will be the temple. Now, you will come to me to worship." No building, no place will ever be the focus again of where and how to meet God. I really appreciated when Dave spoke about the stained glass windows in here. We would be, you know, if something were to happen one day or someone picked up a big rock and threw it through one of these stained glass windows, we would be appalled, wouldn't we? And yet in the whole big picture of things, we are worshiping in a temporary edifice. Jesus says, I will be the place where you can meet God. I am the sacrifice needed to cover the sin. You don't have to bring that to the priest anymore. I am that great high priest, the only mediator between God and man. I am the dwelling place of God. From now on, whenever or wherever men and women and little children want to meet God, they may come to me anywhere, anytime. I think about the Samaritan woman, or the woman at the well, I guess it was. She was said, Where are we going? Where should we go to meet God or worship God? Some say on this mountain, some say in the temple. Jesus says the true worshipers will worship in spirit and in truth. There is no place except for Jesus. The forgiveness they need, they find in me. The intercession they need, they find in me. The God they need, they find in me. I am the new temple, and there will be no other. So to all the atheists out there, to all the agnostics, to all the skeptics out there, we offer this sign, this is evidence, and basically in three parts. One, the temple was destroyed, Jesus was killed, just like he said. It was going to happen. Second, Jesus did build the temple again in 3 days. And that has to do with his resurrection, isn't it? The Roman guards, whoever was guarding the tomb, they couldn't produce the body to show that this was a false claim that Jesus resurrected. They couldn't show that. Third, the temple of Jerusalem was actually destroyed in AD 70. This is a historical fact. The old priesthood did die away. Now they're trying to bring that back, right? And they're trying to do that sort of thing. But these things happened. They happened in history. They are not the delusion of some cultic leader. So Jesus Christ is the divine Son of God. He is alive. He's reigning at God's right hand in the heavens. And he will come one day with power and great glory. And by Jesus' mercy to us, he gives us a sign before that day when he comes in power and glory, that we may be ready, that we may believe now, so that when he does come, it won't be too late. He died. He raised from the dead. He replaced the Old Testament system of meeting God in the temple. He is the temple, and he is the place, the only place, where human beings can meet God. Now you might ask, why would I preach a sermon like this? It's like the Sunday after the commencement address. We're in the midst of going to graduation parties. It's really interesting. You know, I'd never been to a place where they did graduation parties all summer long. Back when I graduated, and this is a long time ago, it was like a one evening thing. You know, you had your graduation commencement ceremony, and then we'd all disperse to our parties, and then we kind of make a progressive trip around all the different parties, and that was it. It's not like it went on all summer long, which I think is kind of cool here. But you might, why couldn't I preach on something that would encourage graduates and challenge them to do their best in the next stage of life? Well, for one reason is, in a very real sense, the university that you may attend, maybe you have attended, it's like the new modern day temple, in a sense. The university certainly isn't trying to appease God in any way. As a matter of fact, many of them do not believe in God. But the university is kind of like the modern center of academia, where they of thinking and culture, just as the temple was in Jesus' day, in a sense. And so the high priest of academia, and we're talking about the professors of all these secular universities, 9 times out of 10, they have nothing to do with the biblical God or a worldview, a Christian worldview. They have everything to do with secular humanism, a worldview that really flies in the face of anything that God in the Bible has about truth. And Jesus says to this new temple, just as he said to the old one, it will be destroyed. Now, I'm not saying don't go to the temple. I'm not saying not go to the university. There is actually some good things that come out of the university. You will learn a lot. You will enroll. I am a product of the secular university. I went there. And it's still operating in many places in the world. And there's certainly no shortages of secular universities. I mean, we get all these different pamphlets in the mail right now. I mean, for my kids who are not even a junior yet. And they're getting things in the mail, advertises about come to this university or that university. So I say, maybe you will go to them. Maybe you will learn from them. Maybe you will get a degree from one or more of those departments. And you will be proud of your accomplishments, as well you should be, if you can make it through there. But remember this. Ultimately, their system is broken. And it's far from perfect. Because, like the Jewish temple, a lot of times they made a conscious effort to forsake God. Do they still offer good to society? In some regards, they do. People go there and they become nurses, and they become doctors and teachers and engineers, and they can do some wonderful things for society. I don't want to discount that at all. But the scriptures also say that the rain falls on the just and the unjust. It's only by God's mercy and patience that the Jewish temples and the synagogues and the secular universities that they still continue to operate. It's by God's patience, loving patience. The world still benefits from the public university because there are echoes of a Christian foundation that still may be ever so slight, but it might still be there. But someday the university, they will breathe their last, just as the Jewish temple will. So here's my challenge to all of us, whether you're a budding college student, maybe you went to college 30 years ago. Never let them convince you that Jesus isn't real, that he's not coming back to set up his kingdom. Never let them convince you of that. Always hold that fast in your heart. Because Christianity is rooted in history. It survived centuries of scrutiny and debate. It is valid and relevant in every culture in the world. It has endured the test of time. It has an absolutely unique person named Jesus, who when you learn about him, you find out he has no beginning, no end. He is the image of the invisible God, became man to be the perfect sacrifice for the sins of the world. I leave you with this one verse from Isaiah chapter 40, verse 8. It says, "The grass withers and the flowers fail, but the word of God stands forever." That's what's eternal here.